Hey friends, welcome back to another episode of The Bible Unmuted. My name is Matt Halstead, and it's a pleasure to be with you once again this week. I'm delighted to share with you this conversation I had with Brian Zond. We chat about his new book, The Wood Between the Worlds, A Poetic Theology of the Cross. In this conversation, we chase a mini rabbit trail, and we go down areas of discussion that are, I think you'll find, fascinating and interesting. We chat about all sorts of things, from theology to church fathers to music and art. We chat about John Mayer and his guitar playing skills. We just go everywhere with this. This is a two-part conversation. This is part one, and next week we will release part two. Well, without further ado, join me in welcoming Brian Zond. Well, we are here with Brian Zond. Brian, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. So you and I have a mutual friend, Doug Main. He connected us, and so shout out to Doug. We appreciate Doug for setting this up. So I've been following your stuff for quite a while, and social media, and I've been wanting to talk to you for quite some time, so it's an honor to have you here on the show. And I was just telling you a moment ago that I could talk to you for about a million hours, but we don't have a million hours. So,
well, thank you, Matt. Those are kind words that you want to talk with me.
Yeah,
that's nice.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a pastor. You've been a pastor for quite some time. What made you go into the ministry? What led you to faith? Tell me about your journey.
Well, I have been a pastor for quite some time. My story is like this. I had a dramatic encounter with Jesus, completely unexpected, when I was a teenager, back in the Jesus movement. This is a long time ago. And that's kind of to this moment, the defining event of my life, where I just overnight went from being the high school Led Zeppelin freak to the high school Jesus freak. And by the time I was 17, I was leading a ministry that it was a coffee house ministry, which, you know, this is where the Jesus movement happened in the 70s. It was mostly a music venue that by the time I was 22, just more or less turned into Word of Life Church, which I have now led for 43 years. So, yeah, I've officially been a pastor for 43 years. Unofficially, I've been doing the work of a pastor longer than I've been an adult,
yeah.
which just sounds crazy to sound it. I'm not advocating it. I'm not endorsing it. I'm not saying this is a good idea. I'm just, you asked my story. And so in one sense, I've been very stable, to use the term that the Benedictines would use. I've had a vow of stability, almost, as it were, in that I've stayed in the town that I've grown up in, lived all my life, and I've stayed with one church for 43 years. But that's just only one way of telling the story. The other way is, oh, what a long, strange trip it's been. And so, because, you know, we started off in the Jesus movement, that led us into the charismatic movement, which I describe as good until it wasn't. I was just a part of that movement. So you don't necessarily make a lot of decisions. You're just kind of along for the ride. But as I entered midlife in my 40s, I began to have a growing sense of unease and dissatisfaction. Now, by the metrics that Americans like to measure success in ministry, if you looked at our church, it was quite large. You know, everything's great, right? On that front, everything's great. It was internally that I was feeling that, I don't know, I was thinking, this feels thin. This feels a little bit cheap. Feels definitely too consumerist, too American. And so that is what launched my project of re-educating myself in the faith, which involved an enormous amount of reading. I mean, I never went to seminary, right? But when I entered my own personal seminary, I read 10 times more than any seminary would ever have dared assign. And so I became a very serious student, first of patristics and then of academic theology, which I found completely thrilling. It was never work for me to read all of this. But that changes me, right? And if it changes me, it changes my preaching. And so then we went through a very long period of time, really about 10 years, I would say from 2004 to 14, where it was a difficult transition to bring our church into what I would describe as a more substantive, thick, rich, historically rooted faith. And we paid the price for that in that we had lost well over 1,000 people, which is like half of our church. But I'm talking about something that was completed 10 years ago. And today we feel like we're in a very good place. So Matt, you asked me, how do I sum up 43 years in 5 minutes? It's impossible, but that should maybe give our listeners a bit of an idea of what my life and journey has been like. And now I write a lot. I've written 11 books in the past 14 years, and I'm sitting at my writing table working on number 12.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, and we'll get to your latest book. I actually finished it this morning, The Wood Between the Worlds, and a ton of questions and thoughts, and would love to hear more about that. I kind of want to, before we get to that, though, is kind of just talk more generally about your influences. You and I have very similar influences, I've noticed, yeah. Through the years, just following you. Eugene Peterson,
yes.
The pastor's pastor, right? I've read it.
Well, and I am happy to be able to say I knew Eugene and counted him as a friend, and he was always very kind and generous to me. And it's like, you know, back in the day, everybody had the WWJD bracelet. What would Jesus do? As a pastor, I like when I have a WWEPD. That's kind of my grounding. Well, what would Eugene Peterson do? So, no, I totally get that.
Yeah, he had such a patience about him, and he was content with the messiness of life. And that's one thing he always says. Yeah. He liked the mess, and that seems so opposite what you would think of someone who's, you know, in the ministry, that he would even admit that it's messy, but yeah. B, that he would embrace it, you know. So, yeah, Eugene Peterson, Robert Alter. I've actually had Robert on the show.
I completed not too long ago. I say not too long ago, it's probably a year ago now.
Yeah.
Of the big project of reading his entire Old Testament translation and commentary. Just start at the beginning, every single footnote. Didn't treat it as a resource book, but I just read the thing.
Yeah.
And it was totally worth it. It was a big reading project. I just read it in the mornings. You know, I'd read it, 15, 20 minutes a day in the morning. It took me about a year to get through it or something like that, but it's totally worth it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Our students in our Hebrew Bible modules, that's their text. And
yeah,
it's a lot of fun to engage his translations. And I mean, he's an artist. That's how I describe him. He's a total
artist. I mean, his background, certainly, you know, his background is not biblical studies or
right.
biblical scholarship. It's in literature. But that's what makes it so fresh, is his literary approach. I mean, I think sometimes we forget. That was one of the biggest takeaways from reading that entire work, is what a work of literary genius the Old Testament is, on different levels, you know. But it's, and he really brought, I find that kind of stuff fascinating anyway, and he really brought that to light. So yeah, loved it.
And here's another name, David Bentley Hart. You know, it's funny. So I don't always agree with his conclusions on one hand. On the other hand, I get really frustrated that people don't engage him more seriously and take his work more seriously. So I'm kind of in this in between. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No one's taken him more seriously than I have, in that I am quite confident that I have literally read everything he's published. I mean, I would be surprised if somebody told me published work.
Yeah.
I mean, I read all of those first things, issues, and they all eventually get collected in various works of his and essays. I'm pretty sure I've read everything he's published.
Wow.
And at this point, I'm just going to keep doing it. So I just keep up with him. I love the guy. I've never met him. So this is not a, you know, I knew Eugene Peterson. Maybe some other people will mention, I know.
Yeah.
I've never met him. I have a few friends that do know him. I know that a lot of people find his pugilistic style a bit off-putting. I take it in a humorous vein. Sometimes it's not quite as humorous. But I just enjoy. I think he's a brilliant mind. I think because he is so formidable, he can maybe at times just run over people. And I have this cadre of friends. You know, we joke. We kind of all read the same stuff, and we've like made a vow that none of us will ever get in an argument with David Bentley Hart, because it doesn't matter whether we're right or wrong. It doesn't matter. It's just not going to end well for us.
Sure. Yeah.
But I'm something of a devotee, and
sure,
but while we're just rambling here, maybe the most enjoyable book I read last year was by his brother, Addison Hodges Hart, Patapsco Spirits, 11 Ghost Stories.
No way. I've never heard of this.
I love this book. I want him to write more. Mm. You wrote 11. Write 11 more. And apparently he's going to. So I would, Patapsco, this is the river, you know, around Baltimore. That's where the Hart family comes from. And I would describe them as 11 theologically informed ghost stories. Some more, some less, but you know, I read it on vacation. It's like the perfect vacation read. But I would only read it at night. You can't read ghost stories in the daytime. Come on. And I recommend Patapsco Spirits by Addison Hodges Hart.
Okay, I'll have to check that out. And that is a perfect segue to the next person I want to mention, Del Allison, Encountering Mystery.
Mm.
I saw something on, I guess it was Twitter or something, not too long ago, and that whole subject is fascinating to me. I'm working on an article, and I have a big book project in mind that I'm working on that kind of stuff. My background is hermeneutics, and so I'm kind of approaching it from an interpretive aspect, I guess, more philosophy, I guess. But anyway, tell me, what are your reactions?
I've read two of his books.
On the show too. We talked about. I guess he was my second interview.
I need to find that. You need to send me a link.
I'll do that. Yeah.
I've read, I think it's called Night Comes. Is that maybe the name of it? It's a book on death.
I've only read two of his books.
That's one I read. And then of course I read Encountering Mystery, which is, you know, you have certain books that you just recommend all the time to people.
Mm-hmm.
That's one I've been recommending a lot lately.
Yeah.
And, there's almost some ghost stories in Encountering Mystery. And that this comes not from some sort of, you know, he has no background in charismatic Christianity. He's just I don't know if he actually wears glasses, but I want to say he's a bespectacled academic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, very, very
highly respected.
Yes, highly respected, very serious, nothing sensationalist about him. But yeah, I found that book really fascinating. So
yeah. No, I did too. Yeah.
So I don't know him. I've never met him, but I do have a New Testament scholar that's a member of our church, and he has had some interaction with him. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, I'll shoot you that chat I had with him. It was a lot of fun. So it kind of brings me back to your stuff here. Modernity seems to have failed us,
mm-hmm.
and we're reaching for the unseen.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why these books that we've just mentioned are probably so appealing to people. And I think that's why I loved about your book. You talk about the atonement through every page. I mean, this is what it's about, and we'll let you share more about that in a moment. But you take a poetic approach. I think it's theopoetics.
Yeah,
that's right. And you approach it through the lens of music. And there are a couple of quotes here, real short ones, but so impactful. And to the listeners, this book is so quotable. It's so good. You say atonement theology is shaped far more by the hymns we sing than by the sermons we hear. Sermons come and go, but the most popular hymns endure for centuries and influence our theological imagination more than we know. And then later on in the book, toward the end, a few more one-liners. Poetry is the best vehicle we have for attempting to articulate the ineffable. That is why so much of the Bible is poetry. And then on down, and what is Revelation, if not a phantasmic poem? And then lastly, and this is really good, quote, the dominant language of our time languishes under the tyranny of prose. Wow, that's beautiful. So yeah, say more about that.
Yeah, that last line, I probably am riffing a little bit on Walter Brueggemann, who we didn't mention. That's another one.
I think
he would be in my top
yeah.
five influences.
Oh, yeah,
and Walter has become a friend. And
yeah, that does follow a quote from him. Prose flattened world. Yeah.
Yeah, that's well, in describing The Wood Between the Worlds as a poetic theology of the cross or my engagement with theopoetics, I need to clarify that it is not a poetry book. I mean, there is some poetry in it, but it's not a poetry book by any means. But what it is an attempt to talk about the cross not being limited to the language of academic prose. So I make no apology for leaning heavily into poetry, but also literature, film, art, movies, all of that sort of stuff. I think that's fair to use that kind of vehicle for trying to talk about the cross. I don't come from the academy. You know, I don't have any academic training, although I do speak in that world increasingly more often. I have the highest respect for the academy. I really do. But since it's not my world, I'm not beholden to it. And what I really sense that I'm trying to do oftentimes is to stand in the gap between the academy that I have such deep respect for and just the wide world of lay people who you know, so we're talking about David Bentley Hart. Lay people are not going to read Beauty of the Infinite. And in fact, if you don't have some real training in philosophy, that's almost an impenetrable book. It's very difficult. And yet, I mean, that is a prime source for the book I wrote, was probably 12 years ago now, Beauty Will Save the World. And so I'm trying to stand in between the two and try to bring the richness that I find theologically in the academy into form that is accessible to the vast majority of at least somewhat reading, thinking Christians. And to do that, though, I'm not going to limit myself to academic prose. I'm going to avail myself of poetry and film and literature and paintings and all of that, songs, contemporary songs, not just, you know, some sort of ancient song. And so that's natural for me to do that. It's not, it wasn't like this was trying to be cute or clever. It's pretty much how I operate anyway. But the book was enjoyable to write because I like doing that.
Yeah. Hey friends, thank you so much for listening to The Bible Unmuted. I hope you're enjoying today's episode. And as I've said many times before, my goal for the podcast is pretty simple. I want to give listeners the tools they need to interpret scripture well. Thank you to everyone who prays for this ministry each and every week. If you find the podcast to be helpful and you think others might enjoy it too, consider leaving a review of the show on your favorite podcast platform and sharing with your friends. Also, if you're interested, consider becoming a patron of the show by visiting our Patreon page. This will give you access to some cool stuff and it helps support the podcast. If you're interested, visit patreon.com/thebibleunmuted or follow the Patreon link in the description for this episode. Thanks so much for your support. All right, let's get back to today's discussion. You know, music has been a big part of my life for a long time as well. And it's interesting because it's at the same time challenging and also inspiring. I mean, I could grab my guitar and put on a John Mayer song or something and try to emulate it. And then he inspires me to play better.
If you can kind of emulate John Mayer, I salute you.
No, I cannot. But he inspires me to play more.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I want to walk away like, why do I even try after listening to John Mayer? But I just keep being tugged and pulled back into it. And I think music, poetry, the arts do that. They confront you with your weaknesses. And yet at the same time, invite you in to play. You know? And I think that...
Now I just want to talk about John Mayer, but okay.
Let's do it. Yeah. What's your favorite John Mayer song?
Well, here's the thing. Yeah. I'm not necessarily a huge John Mayer fan when he does John Mayer. I love him with Dead & Company. where he's, this is, it's actually brilliant, where he is, I describe it like this. He is being very respectful of Jerry Garcia, not completely reinventing his solos and style, but it's elevated. It's like when someone goes off to culinary school and ends up a Michelin star restaurant, and now what they're doing is their grandmother's recipes, but they're elevated. He's taking, this is completely off the subject, but I love it.
No, I love it. He's
taking
great.
Jerry Garcia style guitar playing, being respectful of it, but bringing it up to another level. I love that stuff.
Yeah. Eric Clapton said once, if I remember right, he's like, I don't think John Mayer knows how good he is. I think that's probably accurate.
Because John Mayer can pass himself off as a pop singer-songwriter because he can do that, and he does do that. But if you don't know, lurking behind it is a massive guitar player. I mean, like a seriously really good guitar player.
Right. It's crazy how good he is. That's fun. Okay. So yeah, tell me the genesis of the book. You went on a pilgrimage. Tell us about that.
Yes. My wife, Perry, and I have now, well, we've actually done maybe seven or eight long walking pilgrimages, four on the Camino de Santiago. But our first was, our first on the Camino de Santiago was in 2016. And this, for those who don't know, this is an ancient pilgrim path that the classical route in modern times anyway begins in Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, France, crosses the Pyrenees. 500 miles later, by the grace of God, you arrive in Santiago de Compostela, Spain. So it's a 500-mile walk. That's a big deal. And so we began it, and for our first time, we were nervous a little bit. I mean, we were hikers, and we've done all this. But, you know, to set off on a 500-mile walk, you know, you don't really know what that's going to be like and if you're even capable of it. And so the first day is a very hard day, just physically, because you cross the Pyrenees. It's like a 15-mile day, but it's a 15-mile mountain day. So it's probably the hardest day physically of the whole thing. And we arrive in Roncesvalles in Spain, because the first day you cross the border into Spain. And all the pilgrims stay at the same place because there's nowhere else to stay. You stay in the monastery with its vast dormitories. And so we'd completed that journey, that hike, that stage, and I'd gone into the chapel of the monastery. I'm just sitting, just kind of just really resting, just sitting. And I wasn't consciously necessarily thinking about anything, but I did notice the crucifix. And then, and this brushes up against maybe a mystical kind of experience. I felt like the Spirit gave me instructions for this long journey we were beginning. And the instructions were like this: enter every church you can, pay attention to the crucifix, ask, what does this mean? And don't be too quick to give an answer. And so, Matt, that's what I did for the next 40 days, it turned out to be. 500 miles. It was a walk. So, you know, you're on this ancient religious pilgrim path. So you're passing lots of churches. Some are still active, some aren't, some are open, some aren't. But those that were open, we would enter. I would look at the crucifix, pay attention to it, ask, what does this mean? And then resist to say, well, after all, I'm a pastor. You know, I've been a pastor for 35 years, it was at that point. No, I didn't do that. I just allowed the question to remain open. What does this mean? And because it was a walking pilgrimage, I'm not seeing the same crucifix every day. Like if you went on some sort of retreat to a monastery, you might see one crucifix every day, the same one. No, I was seeing multiple crucifixes every day, and they all were different. In some, Jesus was regal, almost like a king, and you wouldn't even see any suffering. In some, he was, you know, serene, at peace. Others, you would see the brutality of crucifixion. You would see the agony. In some, he was alive. In some, he'd already died. So this began to work on me that there are many ways to tell the central story of the Christian gospel, that is Christ crucified. And because of the nature of what we were doing, you know, the glorious thing about something, this kind of pilgrimage is your life is reduced to a blessed simplicity. I mean, all you're doing is walking 12 to 15 miles west every day. That's it. Yeah, I mean, you have to, you know, you have to find the place to stay. You have to do your laundry, you know, but really your mind is not terribly occupied. And so it's free to go deep. And so with several hours of just walking every day, I was meditating on these things. I was, what does this mean? And I would have those images of the various crucifixes that I'd seen. And I just held on to that. And then we walked this two more times. So it was three. And finally I thought, okay, now I'm ready to start saying some things, but I haven't been too quick to give an answer what this means. In fact, I've sat with this for, you know, 7 years or so. I think that in my mind would qualify as not being too quick, waiting 7 years. And after about 7 years, then I thought, okay, now I'm prepared to say some things. And so, you know, you've read the book, you see that it's either 19 chapters in a long poem. I think of it as 20 chapters, but for some reason, the publisher, I don't know, they didn't think that a long poem at the end was a chapter. I don't know what they thought. So it's 19 chapters in a poem, but it's actually 20 ways, 20 things I see when I look at the cross. And I am not saying there are 20. I'm saying, here's 20. And I know there's 20 more, and then 20 more after that, and 20 more after that. And so I talk about it being a kaleidoscopic approach to the cross. You know how a kaleidoscope works. You point it toward the light, you look through the lens, you see the colors, you see the geometric designs, and then you turn the kaleidoscope, and it changes. Still the same source of light, but the colors and designs are now different. And so I fixed my theological kaleidoscope squarely on the cross, but we turn it 20 times. And then I try to tell you what I see. So that's how the book works.
So there's one line that I think is just packed with so much. I'll read it to you and you can explain it to the listeners. It comes from page 68. It says, "The transformation of the Roman cross from an abhorrent symbol of death into a beautiful symbol of love is a testament to the determining power of Christ. If the cross can be saved, the world can be saved. Mm. If crucifixion can be made beautiful, all things can be made beautiful. The hope we have for the healing of a world marred by sin and death is that God makes all things beautiful in his time." So that one particular line, if the cross can be saved, the world can be saved. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think sometimes we can be so close to a miracle, so familiar with a miracle, that we fail to recognize it as a miracle. So let's just back up a moment and let's think about crucifixion. Well, maybe I'll do it this way. Maybe I'll start the other end. So I am at my writing desk, and I make reference to this in the book, but I always keep this, I don't know if people are going to see this, but this Russian Orthodox cross icon. It's beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous. And if I just showed this to anybody, the average person would go, "Oh, that's beautiful." I mean, if I showed it to just about anybody, certainly in the Western world, say, "Hey, what do you think of this?" I think 90% of them would say, "Oh, that's beautiful." Okay, well, yes, it is. But hold on. What is it? It's a depiction. Well, it tells the story of the Passion on a cross, the story of the cross. Because you understand, when the Romans crucified people, they weren't trying to create art. In fact, they were trying to create something that was as grotesque, hideous, repulsive, abhorrent as possible. I mean, crucifixion isn't a quick, easy way to dispatch people, but it is a way to get your message across. And the message is, you resist the Roman Empire, this is what's going to happen to you. And it was dreadful, and it was so abhorrent that people in the first century would not use the word crucifixion in polite company. They would resort to various euphemisms because it would be like that. All right, so 2,000 years later, we are accustomed to seeing a cross presented in terms of beauty. But I think we just need to pause for a moment and go, wait a minute, how did that happen? There must be a story here somehow. And that's, in one sense, the story I tried to tell in the book. There's an image, or I think this, there's, well, it's not an image. The book has, I think, 16 images. I think it is 16. This is an image that's not in the book, but it's described. It's not in the book because I couldn't find the cartoonist. I didn't know who did it. But it's a cartoon. And the cartoon works like this. So it's just a single panel. So a flying saucer has landed on planet Earth. And the two aliens, you know they're aliens, you know what aliens look like. They've got out of their flying saucer. They happen to have landed their flying saucer right beside one of the large, life-size roadside crucifixes, the kind that are common in Spain. And they're just staring at it. This is their first encounter with this planet. And they're staring at this crucifix, these two aliens. And one alien says to the other, you know what we need to do? We need to get the F out of here. That's what we need to do. Now, I've told that so many times, I still laugh every time I say it. The genius of that cartoon, and I have no idea what the motivation of the cartoonist was. Maybe just to be funny. I think probably that was it. But what the genius of the cartoon does is it enables you to see a crucifix through literally alien eyes, to see one for the first time. And if you're seeing a crucifix for the first time, you see it much differently. And these aliens, the only thing they can conclude is any planet that erects things like this in public must not be a safe place. And we just need to get the F out of here. And you know what? They're not wrong. It's not a safe place. But so that's our starting point. And that's the starting point in the first century. I mean, if you said, okay, let's start a religion, Matt, in the first century in the Roman Empire. And you say, oh, that's a good idea, BZ. Let's start a religion. And I say, well, how about we base it around a crucified Galilean Jew? I mean, it's outlandish. It's the most, that has zero chance of succeeding, except that it does. And so I think in understanding the cross, we need to start with how terrible it was, how abhorrent it was, how scandalous it was. And then we can jump all the way to where we are now and say, well, look, if crucifixion can be made beautiful, then all things marred by sin, all things that have been made ugly because of what's gone wrong with this world, there's hope that God is able to make all things beautiful in his time. If you can take Roman crucifixion and turn it into a symbol of hope, salvation, compassion, it's all the opposite, right? I mean, in its origin, it's none of those things. But as today, we see those things. We see hope, compassion, mercy, salvation, even beauty. I think there's hope for all things. Amen.
And you're not alone. I mean, Paul even says he, you know, boasts in the crucified one, right? And so even early on, there's a boasting in it. There's a finding.
Yeah, Paul knew how absurd it was. He said, this is very offensive in the Jewish world to talk about a crucified Messiah. So it's an offense, a stumbling block, a scandal to Jews. And it's just nuts. It's just ridiculous. It's foolishness to Gentiles, to pagan Gentiles. I mean, they have their gods, their pantheon, but, you know, they're going to be mighty. They're going to be triumphant. They're going to be Zeus. They're going to be Mercury. They're going to be, you know, not a god nailed to a tree. So Paul understands the challenge he's up against, but then adds, but to those who believe, it's the power of God unto salvation. Now I just feel like preaching, Matt.
well, let's go down this road just for a bit. Like, what is beautiful about the cross? What is it about that gives us hope? What is it that Jesus does on that gruesome wood between the worlds?
Well, I can talk about it in 19 or 20 ways. but here is what I will say.
Sure.
The initial instinct of most people, not even just necessarily intentional Christians, but I think just most people, is that somehow, even if they know or don't know, or they have an idea, or they have no idea how it works, the initial association with the cross of Christ is to connect it with forgiveness. I think almost everybody, people have no theological training, go, it has something to do with that. And I believe that instinct is correct. But how do we talk about it so that it remains, in fact, true to scriptures, true to historic Christian theology, and beautiful? I talk about it like this. I'm not saying it's the only way to talk about it. In fact, I will say it's not the only way to talk about it. But one way of talking about the cross associated with forgiveness would be to say this. Good Friday is the moment that all the sins of the world coalesce into a hideous singularity, becoming the sin of the world. The greatest sin possible, the murder of God, deicide. The sins of the world coalesce into a single sin that it all might be forgiven in mass. So I just see all of, you know, the sins all the way, you know, the first Stone Age murders all the way up to whatever would be the final Space Age iniquity, you know, famous sins, infamous sins, hidden sins, all of these things, pride and lust and greed and violence and war, all of it. Coalescing into a hideous singularity that it might be sinned with great violence into the body of the Son of God, that it might be forgiven in mass. Father, forgive them. Now, pause. Here we're going to do a little theology. One of the things we need to keep in mind is that the Son never acts as an agent of change upon the Father, because, first of all, the Father is immutable. The Father doesn't change. This is one of the bedrocks of historic Christian theology, that God is immutable. God does not mutate. God doesn't change. And the Son does not act independently of the Father, much less act as an agent of change upon the Father. This is made very clear in John's Gospel, where Jesus almost on every page is saying something like, I only do what the Father does. I only say what the Father says. I've come to reveal the Father. No one has seen the Father except the Son. The Father and I are one. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. So when Jesus upon the cross prays, Father, forgive them, he's not changing the Father, he's revealing the Father. And so that we could imagine within the triune nature of God, the response to the Father is, of course, Son, that's who we are. And so that's where we begin to see beauty. Yes, the ugliness is present. It's all there. The hideousness, the violence, the lies, the deceit. All of that is present on Good Friday, but there's something even greater. And that's the love of God, the saving love of God that's able to absorb the sin of the world and to recycle it into divine forgiving grace. I mean, I could go on and on and on. I mean, I think that's one point of beginning to talk about it.
So I want to switch gears. Well, it's not really switching gears because it's directly applicable to everything that you just said, but let's talk about nationalism, okay? So on page 33 of your book, you have a second to last sentence of that page. You say, on the cross, we encounter a God who would rather die than kill his enemies.
Yeah.
I know you don't have anything to say about nationalism. You've never really talked about it ever before in your ministry. But yeah, can we wait?
For those that don't know, Matt is employing humor at this moment. This is known as irony. This is...
right. So yeah, let's tread these waters. What say you about nationalism and with respect to the cross? That's the end of today's episode, and thanks again for listening to The Bible Unmuted. If you like this podcast, consider rating it on your podcast platform, subscribing, and sharing with your friends. You can also support the podcast by becoming a Patreon member. Go to patreon.com/thebibleunmuted or simply find the link to the Patreon page in the description for this episode. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, friends.